Well, last week, UpToDate had a conversation after a week of violence across the country that really stunned a lot of people. We brought in a lot of different voices, a lot of different opinions about race, about police, and about what needs to happen next. And so we wanted to continue to dig a little deeper into these tough conversations. Today's topic, how can white people help in the fight for racial justice? We observe violence that occurs in this country all the time, but many of us can observe from a safe distance. Here to help us with this conversation is Anna Svoboda-Stell. She's a community organizer and community health worker from Kansas City. Anna has been a core member of the local organization One Struggle KC for almost 2 years now, and she recently became involved in Showing Up for Racial Justice KC. That's an organization that, as it says, tries to organize white people for racial justice. Anna, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Also at the table today, Alice Chamberlain, as a professional organizer and one of the founding members of Showing Up for Racial Justice, which I will now refer to just as Surge KC. Alice, good morning.
Thanks for having us.
And finally at the table, John Trammell, a social worker with experience in the areas of community organizing, community development, mental health, domestic violence, social justice, education, and organizing. John, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
We should note, you can't see us, but we should note none of the guests, none of the people at the table today in studio are people of color. That is an intentional choice in planning this show. We decided that before we can bring all the voices to the table together, we need to start by having a conversation among white people first. And the hope is that our reasoning for that becomes apparent through this conversation. Let's start with some news last night. Alice, your organization, Surge KC, Showing Up for Racial Justice, had another regular public meeting. You've been having this for a while now, but as I saw on Facebook, more than 300 people showed up to this event last night.
Yeah, so we have regularly monthly meetings the third Monday of every month. And I think in the wake of the recent events in this country and the continued unending violence, especially against people of color at the hands of police, we saw a really huge dramatic increase in the number of white folks who are really trying to find and really examine their role in a racial justice movement.
And what was the conversation last night?
So the conversation was specifically looking at institutional racism and how racism doesn't just exist as really overt and explicit acts of discrimination or prejudice, but is actually within the systems and specific institutions of neighborhoods and educational system, workplaces, et cetera. And how do we as white folks who have unprecedented and elevated access to power in these institutions using that to combat racist practices?
And as I noted, you recently just joined Surge KC. Were you there last night?
Yes, I was last night.
And is this conversation, you know, this is taking on some pretty sensitive issues. Is this conversation an uncomfortable one for a lot of people to have?
I think definitely it is an uncomfortable conversation for a lot of people to have. A lot of white people are, because we're used to having spaces where we are the leaders and we're heard, it's interesting to like step back and look at our privilege in a way where we have to be listening to people of color and leaders of color in our community. And examining our privilege in a more internal way.
I would like to just quickly open up the phones now in case you want to call in, whether you're white or a person of color, your thoughts on the role white people could or should play, if any, in the fight for social justice, 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. John, you've been involved intrinsically in many of these issues that Alice and Anna have touched upon just through your work as a social worker. Things like institutional racism, define what that is, define how that might be different from the kind of maybe more historic versions of overt racism that we're used to learning about in history class.
Absolutely, Kyle. So if we think about this from kind of a two-part equation, that we talk about racial prejudice, those things that we have all been taught of how to view people of color. Those are things such as that people of color are over-emotional, they're irrational, they're manipulative. Those are assaultive terms, but those are terms that have been taught to us in our culture of how to view both implicitly and explicitly. So we have these internalized beliefs about people of color. And then where, like Alice mentioned, where we have power, then in these institutions, these beliefs are acted upon in ways that harm and do great harm to people of color. So, for instance, I'll give you a quick example. A woman mentioned this story last night and an experience she had. She was a white woman who was working, and she was having trouble with her transportation. And so she was late to work several times in a very short period of time. She worked with her supervisor to deal with, and her supervisor was very sympathetic to her, helped her kind of deal with her work schedule, and got her through that period, no harm at work. Just recently, she had a African-American woman coworker who had a very similar experience with transportation issues. And the second day the African-American coworker was late for work, she was reprimanded and written up, and her job was threatened at that point. Two people with a very similar experience, things going on in their life, challenges, and two very different ways of being dealt with by their employer.
Some people may be asking, why just hold the conversation among white people at this point? And this is for any of you. Why not invite in people of color or intentionally try to get them in and have a conversation like last night, which was intentionally directed at just white people?
I can speak to that a little bit. For white people, it's really important to have these conversations with white folks in our own communities. The burden of educating white folks and getting them to take action has been on black and non-black people of color for a really long time, for way too long. And so while we want to look to be accountable to people of color and work with them, we don't need their permission to have these conversations on our own. We've been educated, we know a lot of the answers already, and we have access to plenty of literature to keep learning. The leader of colors all over the country are asking white folks to step up, so we can't wait to be asked individually to have these conversations.
And I would just add to that, you know, I think a really good example is, you know, women who suffer domestic abuse are never asked to kind of be in a room to process and discuss their experiences with men because they were oppressed by men. And I think it's really a similar example where we know that it can be very uncomfortable for people of color to have to monitor and worry about the feelings of white folks as they are processing and trauming or processing their traumatic experiences with racism and the healing that they need. So we know that we've got work to do, and it's our own responsibility as white people to take the initiative with that.
Let me push that thinking just a bit. So, I mean, I can imagine a lot of white people who are listening are hearing a thought like that and being compared to a domestic abuse situation and say, I've never oppressed a person of color in my life. I'm not racist. And what is your response to what I think would be a fairly common response?
Well, I mean, I think what I said earlier about those negative beliefs that were taught about people of color, that our society teaches all of us that we are, that white people are superior to people of color. And many times it's not necessarily an explicit thought. It can be very implicit. It's buried deep down. So we may think we're being colorblind or not paying attention to race, but actually we're living out a deep belief within us that causes us to respond to people of color in ways that are harmful. And we may not even be conscious of it because belief, a lot of our belief systems are part of our unconscious thinking and come out in our actions. And so it's up to white people to really pay close attention to monitor ourselves. And when we feel like we may have had a reaction or said something in a way that we say, what was that about for me? What's going on for me? What's going on deep down about what I believe that makes me think this way or act this way? I think it isn't meaning that we're all these terrible people who are trying to harm folks, but it's about paying attention that we all have work to do.
For an event like last night, do you have people show up who have never thought about these types of issues and how do you kind of bring them in and talk to them?
Yeah, that's actually been a really active part of our discussion, kind of as a coordinating committee of Surge KC, that we recognize some people are coming to these meetings with decades of experience in anti-racist movements, and some people are really just examining for the first time what white privilege is. And so that's a huge, exciting challenge for us to be stepping into. And I think as much as possible, we kind of try to engage people in the middle, assuming some kind of understanding, but not expertise, and encouraging people to be building relationships in these meetings, to encourage and support each other as much as possible and mentor each other outside of these spaces.
Have you gotten a lot of pushback? I mean, I can imagine this being a fairly brittle conversation. I know one of the terms floating around out there now is white fragility. Mm-hmm. And if you could kind of explain, or someone at the table explain what that may mean, and then what you do if someone is kind of having that brittle or defensive response.
Sure. I mean, I think the idea of white fragility is that as white people, we've been taught that we are individuals, that we don't have to think of ourselves racially. So when race comes up, it's uncomfortable because it's a conversation that we're not taught to have or that we should have to have. And so we get real defensive because these conversations are shaking the core of how we believe the world works. And so, you know, that's disturbing. Anytime that we have a conversation that disrupts our reality. But what we encourage white folks to do is sit with that discomfort, you know, sit in it, hold on, don't justify, don't deny, don't blame, sit with your feelings, and maybe even ponder the question, if this is true, what does it mean for me?
We do have some callers, and I think Paul, who's now on the line, has a question or a request that might come just off what you're just saying, John. Paul from Overland Park, you there?
Yes. Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to have a couple of examples, if you would, of subconscious racism. Overt racism, I'm familiar with, you can see it and so forth. But subconscious, I'm very unclear about that. When I first heard the term, I thought it was, oh my God, there is no solution to any of this. So if you could give me a couple of examples, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah. John?
Yeah, sure. I mean, one of the things I'm thinking about is, so let's take a school teacher, for instance. And the school teacher has students who are white and students who are black and brown. And that teacher has a white student who is acting up or being disruptive. And the default understanding of that white kid is, Frank is a good kid who's kind of getting out of line or just being silly or just needs redirecting. But once again, if we're approaching with a deep-seated belief about an African-American kid who's acting in the same way, that we approach that with those deep-down prejudices that this kid is being manipulative, that their intentions for what they're doing is malicious, then I'm going to respond much more abruptly and rigidly to that kid. And the discipline that I take with that student is going to be more severe. And so that kid may end up kicked out of class in the in-school suspension room. Now he's missed, you know, she or he has missed work assignments. And it's negatively impacted that kid's life when they were acting the same way. And that teacher may not even fully realize that reaction they had to that child was based on these deep-seated beliefs. That's why we have to deeply examine how we believe.
Let's go to the next caller, Justin in Kansas City, Missouri.
Yes, hi, love the show. Thank you to the panelists for your important work. I had a comment and wanted to get your reaction to it. Just in thinking about racism and the way white privilege operates at the systemic level, it is less about the actions of individual white people and more about how a system is operating that privileges white people and oppresses people of color. I wanted to get your reaction to that, and I'll take my comment off the air.
Alice or Anna, is it possible for individuals to make a difference?
Oh, definitely. I think, you know, that the first caller also recognizing, I think we oftentimes can get stuck and overwhelmed by both feelings, and this kind of just overwhelming sense of racism is so big and so deep and so pervasive. But one of the things we actually really challenge white folks to do in our work in Surge is actually to take a really intentional look at how racism is costing us in our own lives. So yes, white privilege is real and we benefit from the system of racism, but overall, majority of folks in our society and in our country are actually losing because of racism. And economic inequality is a really great example of this. So we often, folks around this country feel like they are struggling. Health insurance costs are going up. Wages are stagnant, people are losing jobs, and that's real. And what we often want to blame that struggle on is those people, immigrants, people of color that are taking our jobs, taking our access to economic opportunity. And we are getting distracted from corporate leaders and politicians who are actually the people that are making decisions that are blocking raises in minimum wages, or who are choosing to cut taxes for corporations and wealthy people, and that are limiting the access of the majority of people to economic and flourishing opportunity. And so I think it's really important when we do look at this systematic lens that we actually identify how we as white people have an interest in dismantling racism. And we're not doing this from a position of wanting to help people of color. But we're doing this because we are actually, although much to a much lesser extent than people of color, but we are impacted by racism as well.
Anna, someone who's just kind of recently begun to work with Surge, again, Showing Up for Racial Justice, that's the name of the organization. Has this been a particularly fraught time to have these conversations, considering the violence around the nation and I think the very real and palpable feelings of tension between races?
Yeah, I think it's a really important time to be having these conversations. And one other thing I'd like to add to what Alice was saying was that it's really important time to be accountable to people of color. So accountability to people of color is a core principle central to working for racial justice and trying to get transformative change. This means that we as individuals and as a group are answerable for our decisions and for our actions. And we do that by building and creating sustainable relationships with communities of color and finding existing leaders of leaders of color in Kansas City to start forming those relationships. Surge is actually trying to do that right now to form an accountability council, which will look like engaging and working with these leaders who offer feedback on our strategies and when we're organizing.
We do just have a couple of minutes left. So for all three of you, what's next in the Metro? What's next locally? And what do you hope to see?
So a couple things that we just want to kind of lay out there as steps that white folks can be taking to get involved in this work and to step up and show up themselves for racial justice. One, I think, as John really laid out, there's an important examination that we all have to do within ourselves to examine white supremacy and how that exists. We need to reach out within our networks of friends and family and neighbors to have conversations about how racism is playing out in our lives and what that looks like. And then we do need to show up publicly. So we've got a couple opportunities to do that. One of them being our End White Silence action this Saturday, July 23rd, 5:30 at J.C. Nichols Fountain. We recognize overall as white people, we are way too quiet when it comes to acts and issues of racism, and we need to be a much louder voice supporting people of color who have been putting their lives on the line around this for way too long. And also, you can, you know, follow us with our Facebook page, Showing Up for Racial Justice Kansas City. And Anna is going to talk about a couple of solidarity events we're also supporting.
Yes. Yeah, so I also work with One Struggle KC, which was founded by and continues to be led by women of color. So that is a local organization you can really look to for upcoming events and articles about what is going on from the perspective of leaders of color in Kansas City's community. So you can follow their Facebook at One Struggle KC, and they also have a Twitter, One Struggle KC. We've got a few things coming up. We have a public meeting next Tuesday, and we also have a direct action training and a call to action coming up in August.
Well, Anna Svoboda-Stell, Alice Chamberlain, John Trammell, thank you so much for this conversation. That conversation will continue here at KCUR Up to Date and at other KCUR outlets.